The B&O, even though it ended up in West Virginia, still was subject to some threat from the Confederacy. Lee's army during the Antietam campaign in 1862 struck at different parts of the B&O after withdrawing back into Virginia and maintaining a position along the Potomac. And Jubal Early's little Army of the Valley in 1864 also tried to interrupt the B&O, tried to tear up small parts of it and interdict some of the goods that moved along it. But for the most part, the B&O made it through the war relatively unscathed, and the rest of the railroads in the North did entirely. The improvements were significant in railroad transport in the North. Gauges were standardized. This had been a problem before the war. There was not a standard gauge for railroads either in the North or the South, and you often had the phenomenon of a railroad coming in from one direction to a city with one gauge. The goods need to go out a different direction on a different gauge, and you would have to unload everything, put it in drays, reload it on the other side of town. It was a problem. The North did a good deal to help rectify this problem during the course of the war. Much work in standardizing gauges. North built many new bridges, improved old bridges, laid new track, produced cars that were both larger and better rolling stock than their earlier versions had been, and also made a number of improvements in locomotives. The government intervened occasionally to see that the railroads met the needs of the military, but not very often. The North fought the war with minimal government intrusion in the economy, another quite remarkable element of this whole economic performance. But occasionally, the Northern government did intervene, as it did when the great movement of troops from the Army of the Potomac west to reinforce the Union forces at Chattanooga took place. The old 11th and 12th Corps from the Army of the Potomac moving to the Tennessee Theater in the autumn of 1863. There was a really impressive degree of cooperation between the United States military and the owners and managers of the railroads that made that transfer of 20,000 troops or so a model of what this kind of cooperation would bring. Again, a great contrast between how the North shifted all those troops from Virginia to the West and how the Confederacy did it when it shifted James Longstreet's two divisions to reinforce Braxton Bragg. They're essentially doing the same thing, but the much better quality of the Northern railroads, the tremendous cooperation between the military and the government made the Northern movement a model that put the Confederate movement to shame, really. In occupied areas of the South, the United States Army took over the railroads and created what was called the USMRR, the United States Military Railroad. The United States Military Railroad, by the end of the war, operated more than 2,000 miles of track in the South, had more than 400 locomotives, more than 6,000 cars, and stood as the largest railroad in the world, and also one of the more efficient ones. There was an absolutely splendid group of engineers who worked with the United States Military Railroad. Engineers, not locomotive engineers, but engineers trained to build things. They became absolutely proficient at repairing bridges, building new bridges, improving sections of track. The U.S. Military Railroad was a very impressive operation as we go toward the end of the war. If we scan the rest of the Northern economy just to see how selected other sectors of it performed during the war, we can see that some did very well and others less so. Understandably, one of the hardest hit elements of the Northern economy was textile manufacturing, dependent on Southern cotton. It was a very rough time for much of the conflict for this part of the Northern economy. It suffered tremendously because of the loss of Southern cotton. We've seen the ways in which the United States government tried to bring cotton to the North. We've seen Abraham Lincoln's concern about sources of cotton in Texas when he wanted to move to the Trans-Mississippi after the Vicksburg campaign, for example. Nathaniel P. Banks, as the commander in the Trans-Mississippi aiming toward Texas, he was from Massachusetts, as we've said, he was also very interested in getting control of sources of cotton in Louisiana and Texas so that that cotton could end up in the mills in New England. We've seen that some Southerners were willing to sell cotton to the North, quoted from some of them, to make money during the war, Southern profiteers, Confederate profiteers. That cotton also ended up in New England. Most of